Welcome to the program, Our Father's Plan, with Jeff Cavins and Scott Hahn.
Welcome to Our Father's Plan. It's good to have you with us. I'm Jeff Cavins, and I'm here with Dr. Scott Hahn from Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. It's good to have you.
Good to be here again.
And Scott is a good friend of mine. We have been in the middle of, we're in the middle of a series. We're studying the Bible together. We're learning how to read the Bible in chronological order. And the Bible is really what brought me back to the Catholic Church, the Bible and the Catechism.
Stay with me.
Did it?
Absolutely.
The Scriptures are just absolutely chock-filled with jewels and wonderful insights. It gives us the blueprint of our Father's plan. And that's what we're talking about. If you just joined the series, we're reading through the Bible in chronological order, and I'd like to invite you to obtain one of these Bible Timeline Band packets. You can call EWTN or write to EWTN, find out how you can obtain one of these. And it's a little memory device to help you read through the Bible in chronological order. We give you the 14 historical books to take you through, like Gone with the Wind or like a novel, so it reads like a story. And then we show you where the other 59 books fit in. It comes with a little timeline band, a memory device to help you, in a little laminated card. Dr. Hahn, we've been talking about the Scriptures, and in today's program we're going to be looking at the New Testament, specifically the Gospels, and I know that Matthew's Gospel is really special to you. Before we get into the New Testament and talk about Jesus, let's talk just a little bit about our families. I'm married, lovely wife Emily, I have one daughter, Carly. You're married to Kimberly, you have five beautiful children. We ended our last program by talking about how the hearts of the children are restored to the Father. And I know that the Bible plays a center place in your family as it does in mine. Both of us, former Protestant ministers, really, you're a convert to the Catholic Church. I'm a revert. I left the church when I was about 20, and I came back to the church. The Bible has been important in our family. Could you share with us a little bit of how you have incorporated the Bible into your own family devotions and the place it plays in the Hahn household?
Yeah, that's good too, because it isn't just simply personal study. Study of the Bible, for me, can become very academic, very theological, but there has to be a real practical dimension too for there to be balance. And what we strive to do each day is to begin the day with family devotions. And we begin by making an act of consecration, each of us together. And then we also single out the scripture passages from the lectionary that are the readings from the daily mass. And we might give a brief commentary on those. And then we go on with family devotion. But in the past, what I've been trying to do with my older kids, Michael, who's now 13, and Gabriel, who's 11, and sometimes Hannah gets to sit on this too, we sit down after the family devotions are over, and we just take a portion of one of the Gospels. Most recently it was Mark. And we'll read maybe 8 or 10, 12 verses. We take a particular story, and we read it, and then we tear it apart. We put ourselves back then, and we make ourselves, you know, we make the story come alive by discussing what would it have been like to see Jesus do this, or to hear him say this. And sometimes, you know, it's set apart for about 15 or 20 minutes, but quite frequently we've gone 30 or 40 minutes. And I especially like delving into the Old Testament background with my older kids, because they have shown me that really does make the New Testament come alive. It just gives a certain three-dimensional quality to it. It just shows you how deep the roots go, and how much you really have to understand to appreciate all that Jesus is, all that he says, all that he does.
Do you think that the average Catholic family that's viewing this program, if they want to incorporate the Bible into their family devotions, do they have to be a scholar, or is this something they need to be afraid of?
No, in fact, being a scholar might be an impediment for some, I suppose. But no, we've said in previous sessions that the Bible is not a textbook for theology. It's not a manual for scholars to study. It really is. I like to tell my students it's like a sandbox. The Father built it for the kids to play in it. It's like a pool. Just go in and swim around and have fun. I mean, You got to know your way around, sure. But at the same time, sometimes the best fun you can have with the Bible is just opening up and reading it and discussing it. And you don't need, you know, a graduate degree. You don't need a lot of scholarly expertise. Commentaries can help, Bible dictionaries, whatever else you can find in the way of useful tools, sure. But don't let those get in the way of just opening up the Bible and hearing your Father speak. It really enables you to discover the fact that the doctrine of divine sonship isn't just a doctrine. I am a child of God. Mm-hmm. And I discover that in my own practical, everyday, existential experience when I read the Bible and I consider it as coming from my Heavenly Father.
What you just said reminded me of the catechism. I had already pulled this out, the new Catholic catechism. In Article 104, in the sacred books, the Father who is in heaven comes lovingly to meet his children and talks with them. I used to have the idea that the Bible was sort of a foreign book, and I was scared to read it. But the Church teaches us that the Bible is really our Father coming to us lovingly to meet with us as children.
And I think what we're doing in this show should help a lot for families who want to delve into the Bible, not just for students and scholars, because, you know, salvation history, looking at the Bible as our Father's plan, is the key to differentiating. I mean, what's the difference between Jack and the Beanstalk and David and Goliath? Well, the fact is, one's a historical event and the other is not, but this event took place in time for our Father's purposes in saving us, in drawing us together in a worldwide covenant family we call the Church.
Yeah.
And it just electrifies, it excites people in their
faith. Well, it's encouraging to me to see scholars like yourself who not only study the Bible from an academic point of view, but you put it into practice in your own family. I know that many times I've come over to your house in the morning and your family is all gathered in the living room reading scripture together. This isn't something that you just talk about in conferences and tapes at school, but you're living it in your own family, and I think that your own family bears it out. You're bearing fruit. In our family, well, it's my wife and my daughter. In the morning before my daughter goes to school, we take the scriptures and we read them. Right now we're reading another type of book. It's a book that treats the Bible sort of as a novel, and we're reading through it as a novel. We've also read through it as a family in chronological order using the 14 historical books. And my daughter is challenged by it. She's fascinated by it. But every day before she goes to school, and I know you bless your children all the time.
Yeah.
Every day before my daughter goes to school, I think it's important to bless our children. And I will put my hand on her head and I'll say, Carly, I bless you. And I pray over her before she goes to school. When she was really little, like first and second grade, before she would go to school, if I forgot, she would come over to me and she would put her head out like this and she'd say, Dad, the blessing.
Yeah.
So, but the Bible, I think we can incorporate this into our family.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that blessing, though, because that's where we go beyond family Bible study to family Bible practices. Because, you know, the Bible shows us, beginning in Genesis, that God conveys his blessings to us through others. And God wishes to convey his blessing to our children through their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the father has a special role as the head of the home, as a kind of covenant representative, as an image of God, the Father. In Genesis, you see how the fathers transmit the divine blessings by the laying on of hands. And you're right, I do that every morning and every evening before our kids go to bed. It's standard. And it's something that when I'm out of town, I do it over the phone because the kids just really expect it. And is it magical? Is it superstitious? Is it mechanical? No. But it is the way that we as a family experience the interpersonal communion that God himself is all about as the Trinity. And that's what the Bible enables us to do.
Well, we have just finished the Old Testament. We read through all 10 periods of Old Testament history, and now we're about ready to go into the New Testament. And if you're like me, you probably know more of the New Testament stories than you do the Old. But as Dr. Hahn has shared with us, it's very important to have a familiarization with the Old Testament in order to really understand the New Testament. What we want to do in this segment of the program is to help you navigate through the New Testament a little bit in your Bible reading program, where I assume that you're reading with us through the Bible. We're going to be picking up on our first New Testament books. The New Testament has 27 books in it altogether, and they are divided up in different categories. We have four Gospels, and the four Gospels, that's what we're going to talk about today. They talk about the life of Jesus. We also have a book of Acts, which I would call a historical book in the New Testament. It takes us through the history of the early church. There are also 21 letters written by different individuals, 13 of which are written by the Apostle Paul. And we also have the book of Revelation, the book of the Apocalypse. And that is a little bit different, and Dr. Hahn, I'm sure, will be commenting on that as we talk about that in our New Testament segment. Look with me on our chart. We have been reading through the 14 chronological books of the Bible, and we call these 14 historical books. And I must reiterate that when we say historical, we're not saying that the other 59 are non-historical or they didn't happen. We simply mean by historical that the events move, the narratives move from one event to the other, so that you can read the Bible more like a story. And it is a story. It's our Father's plan. We started out in the book of Genesis. We moved to Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and then we went through the 70-year exile. After the exile, the children of Israel returned, and we picked up with the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, 1st Maccabees. And then we come to the break between the Old and New Testament, approximately 100 years. Now, throughout all of these 14 historical books, this chart shows you where the other 59 books come into the picture. And it's important to read the prophets where they belong. It's important to read the Psalms where they belong if you really want to understand the historical context. Well, in the New Testament, as I said, we have 27 books. And what we want to do is focus on the four Gospels today. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Dr. Hahn about Jesus, specifically the Gospel of Matthew, and how Jesus is a fulfillment of all that we have spoken of in the Old Testament. There are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The word Gospel is really a modernization of the Old English Godspell, or Godspell, meaning good news, and that's what the Gospels are. It's the proclamation of the good news. Four individual accounts of the life of Jesus. Each has a different emphasis, and each is really written for a different audience. And so you kind of get to pick which book you want to read, but you're going to learn from all of them. And all of them together really give us a complete picture of Jesus' life. There are three Gospels known as synoptic Gospels. The word synoptic simply means to see together. There are three of them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and they share common sources. They write about the same events. It's like they're seeing together, but they give us a little bit of variety. And then we have the Gospel of John, which is a little bit different. Let's go through these real quickly before we talk to Dr. Hahn. The Gospel of Matthew was really written for a Jewish audience. When you read the Gospel of Matthew, you'll pick up on a lot of Hebraic thought. Starts off with a genealogy of Jesus. Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Which, if you were a Jewish person reading the Gospels and you wanted to know about Jesus, the genealogy would be very important to you. You may remember in our earlier section on the history of the early world, we talked about, if you were with us, the Toledot, the genealogies. Well, genealogies are very, very important. So Matthew has a Jewish audience primarily in Palestine. And the theme of Matthew is Jesus as King and Messiah. Another theme of Matthew is the kingdom of heaven. The Gospel of Matthew draws very heavily from the Old Testament. In fact, Matthew uses over 130 quotations and illustrations from the Old Testament. So as you're reading through Matthew, it would behoove you to really get more accustomed to the Old Testament. The title Son of David is very important in the Gospel of Matthew. It occurs 9 times. Well, the Messiah was to be of the lineage of David. The most famous part of Gospels Matthew comes in Matthew chapter 5 through Matthew chapter 7, and that's called the Sermon on the Mount. Take some time this week and read the Sermon on the Mount. The Gospel of Mark is our second Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The author of Mark was not one of the original disciples of Christ. He was, however, a native of Jerusalem, a companion of Simon Peter and a cousin of Barnabas. The writer of Matthew was Levi, and he was a disciple of the Lord. Now, the audience of the Gospel of Mark is really a Roman audience. And it is the shortest of all of the Gospels. The theme presents Jesus as a worker. He is a worker. He's the servant of Jehovah. The Gospel of Mark is a delightful Gospel to read. Our third of the Synoptic Gospels is the Gospel of Luke. Luke, of course, was a physician. He's the only Gentile writer in the New Testament. Originally, the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts were connected to one another. Later on, they were separated. As I said, Luke was the only Gentile writer. He was a companion of Paul. And Luke was a Syrian from Antioch. Now, Luke wrote to a Greek audience. Matthew wrote to a Jewish audience in Palestine. Mark writes to a Roman audience. Luke writes to a Greek audience. Oftentimes, I have noticed that people, they kind of attach themselves to Luke. They understand where Luke is coming from. Maybe it's because they have more of that Western mind. I'm not sure. Now, the theme of Luke is the universality of the Christian message. Luke also stresses the humanity of Christ. He really stresses that. There are more references to prayer in the Gospel of Luke than any of the other Gospels. And also in Luke, Luke contrasts the first Adam with the second Adam, Jesus. He does that quite a bit. One of the reasons that I like Luke, particularly as a Roman Catholic, is the emphasis upon Mary and the infant narratives of Jesus. We have the Magnificat, and many of the joyful mysteries of our rosary come from the Gospel of Luke. Now we turn to the Gospel of John, the fourth of our four Gospels. And this, of course, was written by John the Apostle, the son of Zebedee, the brother of James. He had a nickname called the Son of Thunder. He and his brother were known as the Sons of Thunder, very zealous individuals. The audience of the Gospel of John is really, some people say, a universal audience. But I would suggest to you that it is a Jewish Christian audience, but not in Palestine, but a Jewish Christian audience in the diaspora. Those Jews who have been dispersed as a result of persecution and the earlier exiles. The theme of the Gospel of John states his purpose. And that is that he says in the Gospel in chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, he places his emphasis upon three important words: signs, believe, and life. These things were written that you might believe and have life. So also, I just might make mention that in the Gospel of John, we have the very famous seven I ams. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. This, of course, all speaks of Jesus. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I am the true vine. Now, John is a little bit different than the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. 92% of the material in John will not be found in the other Gospels. And so it gives us a little bit of a different perspective. Only 8% of the material in John will be found in the Synoptic Gospels. Well, we're going to return in just a moment, and we're going to discuss with Dr. Hahn this whole New Testament period, and we're going to find out how Jesus fulfills the Old Testament, and we're going to take a deeper look into the Gospel of Matthew. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Our Father's Plan.
Teach us, good Lord, to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor and not ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do your will.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Hahn, and we are now going to go into the New Testament. I just gave sort of a little overview of the four Gospels. We've been through an awful lot of Old Testament history, an awful lot of events, an awful lot of people, but it all points to Yeshua. It points to Jesus, the Messiah. And so why don't you take us into the New Testament now, and let's begin to discuss the Gospels.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to carry along a lot of what we've discovered and studied in the Old Testament, because that's going to really come alive in the New, and it's going to make the New make a whole lot more sense as well. The Gospel of Matthew, a lot like the Gospel of John, was written by one of the 12 apostles, according to early church tradition. Matthew is identified with Levi, the tax collector. Matthew is writing his gospel most likely for a largely Palestinian Jewish Christian audience. So his original readers came from a Jewish background, and they were steeped in the Old Testament traditions. And I think that helps us understand why Matthew's gospel has a certain set of distinctive features. For instance, in Matthew's gospel, Matthew presents Jesus more clearly, more continuously, in terms of being the son of David, than you find in Mark or Luke or John. And that follows another thing, too, that Matthew's primary theme is Jesus' announcement of, his inauguration of, the kingdom of God. No, it's really the kingdom of heaven. The stress that Matthew places upon the kingdom is that it's heavenly. And this is a good corrective or adjustment or reminder to Palestinian Jewish Christians that the kingdom that the Messiah is ushering in is not going to be a this worldly, earthly, military theocracy. It is going to be an eternal kingdom that we've really been made for from the beginning. So Jesus as the Son of David, establishing the kingdom of heaven through his 12 apostles. The 12 apostles are going to be sort of like spiritual sons of the new Israel. Just as Jacob Israel had 12 sons and they fathered the 12 tribes of Israel, so Jesus represents the new Israel, and the 12 disciples are going to be the means by which he renews Israel and draws all the Gentiles into it. We could say a whole lot more about Matthew's theological perspective, the way he presents Jesus, but I think the best way to begin is just by diving into the opening chapters here in Matthew's Gospel. We notice in the opening verse, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, Matthew has just singled out the only two individuals in the Old Testament who received from God an explicit divine covenant oath. Remember way back in Genesis 22, where God saw Abraham obey, pass the test of obedience by offering up Isaac, his only beloved son, as a holocaust atop Moriah. He interrupted that sacrifice and said, "Because you have done this, I swear by myself." He puts himself under a covenant oath. In effect, he puts himself under a conditional curse. He says, "I swear by myself, I will bless all the nations through Abraham's seed." The blessing that God spoke of in that oath, of course, is the blessing of salvation. Now he is going to deliver on the goods. He's going to fulfill the covenant oath. And this kind of covenant logic is going to help us not only to understand Matthew, but later on in future sessions, we're going to look at how St. Paul, for instance, describes Jesus taking upon himself the curse. And that language is striking. It's almost strange. How can Jesus become a curse for us? Well, if you see that God has sworn this covenant oath to Abraham, he's saying, in effect, "I will bless all the nations through your seed, or I will be accursed. I will do whatever it takes to bring the blessing of salvation through your seed to all the Gentiles, to all the nations. Whatever it takes." Well, because of man's sin, whatever it takes becomes the crucifixion. And so God shows us that even if it takes the sacrifice of his own son, he'll do that. And so the son bears the curse that was triggered by Israel violating the covenant oath 400 or 500 years later. Nevertheless, God bound himself to Abraham and through his seed to bless all the nations. And so it's this covenant logic that Matthew and Paul and other New Testament writers are thinking of when they stress the fact that Jesus is the son of Abraham or the seed of Abraham. But we also see the son of David. David, of course, was the other one who received from God an explicitly sworn covenant oath. We saw that back in 2 Samuel 7. And through the son of David, God was to establish a kingdom covenant that would not only elevate Israel, But all the Gentiles would also be included in that. After that verse, we come across, oh no, those horrible genealogies.
Well, we can move on to chapter
6. Yeah, right. Okay. Let's skip over all these names we can't pronounce, right? Wrong. You can't afford to do that. The genealogies in the Old Testament, we've already seen how important they are. They're no less important here. Matthew structures this genealogy in a rather interesting fashion. It's an abbreviated genealogy. It's a kind of periodic framework so that salvation history is divided up into three periods. You have the period from Abraham to David, and then second, David to the exile, and then, as you pointed out, from the exile to the coming of Christ. So why is he telling us the genealogy to verify what he just said in the opening verse? Jesus really is the son of Abraham. He really is the son of David, and here's proof. Yeah. But the genealogy is unique in another way, because unlike most genealogies, four times women are mentioned. Tamar is mentioned there in verse 3, Rahab in verse 5, and then Ruth also in verse 5. And then in verse 6, Bathsheba is mentioned, though not by name. She's just mentioned as the wife of Uriah. Now, typically, you wouldn't find women being named in genealogies. You have to wonder, why would Matthew include women here in this genealogy? And there's lots of reasons I suspect you could find. One would be because, you know, these women, Tamar was a Canaanite, Rahab was a Moabite, Ruth was a Moabite also. I'm sorry, Rahab was a Canaanite, and Ruth was the Moabite, and the wife of Uriah, Bathsheba, was most certainly not an Israelite. So it shows how God was including Gentiles from the very beginning. So it's sort of preempting any objection that, you know, how can Gentiles now be included? But I think it serves another function, a kind of apologetic function. Because if Matthew is writing his gospel to a Palestinian audience consisting mostly of Jewish Christians, there's probably going to be some Jewish non-Christians. People who are saying Jesus isn't the Christ. He is not the son of David. He was born of rather shady circumstances. You know, Matthew's going to go on and describe the virgin birth of Mary, something that was hotly disputed and denied, of course, by those who refused to accept Jesus as their Messiah. You know, somebody might say, well, look at the circumstances in which Jesus was born. That precludes any consideration of him being the Messiah. Matthew's done something very special, very strategic here. He said, in effect, look, nobody questions whether or not David was anointed by God. Nobody questions whether Solomon, the son of David, was appointed to be this kingly figure. Well, if you look at their genealogy, what do you find? Tamar was a Canaanite woman guilty of incest. Rahab was a Canaanite guilty of prostitution. Ruth was a Moabite. And the wife of Uriah became the mother of Solomon in an adulterous relationship with David. So in effect, Matthew is saying, before you even raise any objections about the virgin birth or whatever, you can't possibly rule out the possibility that Jesus is the Messiah because of the questionable circumstances, because you'd end up having to rule out David himself, right, and Solomon also.
Right.
So the genealogy is told not only to prove Jesus' pedigree is Abrahamic and Davidic, but to kind of preempt any objections about his birth being a messianic birth.
Two things strike me, Dr. Hahn, about
sure.
this genealogy. One is that in the genealogy, you have these, as you mentioned, the four women. And thinking back to the proto-evangelium, Genesis 3:15, we have this acorn that is beginning to grow and branch out the human race.
Right.
And this genealogy reminds me that this is not an exclusively Jewish program, but that God does have all the nations in mind in our Father's plan. And I think that strikes me. How do you see that?
That's a critical point. The opening chapters of the Bible prevent us from ever seeing God's family plan as being exclusively Israelite. That is, there is no monopoly on God's fatherly favor. The call of Abraham is preceded by the unveiling of his whole family plan for the family of Adam, for the family of Noah. Abraham and his seed, later on identified with Israel, are singled out precisely for the purpose of bringing the blessing of God, the blessing of Abraham, to all the nations, and that's what Matthew sees.
As you reiterated in an earlier program, Exodus 4:22, that Israel stands as the firstborn among many nations.
Exactly, right. Now, something else to see in the opening chapters of Matthew's Gospel. Matthew is depicting the historical facts surrounding Jesus' birth in a way that will evoke from his Jewish Christian readers certain Old Testament reminiscences. For instance, if you consider how Moses was born, remember when Moses was born, there was an imperial edict from a wicked king, the Pharaoh, that all Hebrew male children were to be slaughtered. Well, when Jesus was born, King Herod also issues a similar decree to wipe out all the Hebrew male children there in Bethlehem. And then through Joseph's dream, of course, Israel was saved down in Egypt, and through another Joseph's dream, Jesus is not only miraculously spared the destruction, but he's taken down to Egypt, where Mary and Joseph raise him until Herod's death. And when Herod dies, the prophecy is fulfilled there in Matthew 2, verse 15. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Well, Hosea said that there in Hosea 11, verse 1. He was looking back on the Exodus, how God brought Israel out of Exodus, out of Egypt, under the leadership of Moses. But now Matthew sees an even greater fulfillment of that in Jesus. And it's interesting to see some other parallels also, because you see Jesus then going into, coming up out of Egypt, passing through the water of baptism in chapter 3, much like Moses and Israel passed through the waters of the Red Sea in their deliverance. And then Moses fasted for 40 days in the wilderness. Well, what does Jesus do after passing through the waters? He also fasts for 40 days in the wilderness. Moses, after his 40-day fast, delivers the law of the Old Covenant from a mountain. Jesus, after fasting for 40 days, delivers the law of the New Covenant from a mountain. It's the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew 5, 6, and 7, Jesus, as a new Moses, bringing about a new Exodus, gives us a new covenant and hence a new law. Unlike the law of Moses, however, which was given under sinful circumstances with the golden calf and brought down the curses of the covenant, the law of the new covenant brings blessings. And so it's fitting for Jesus to begin the revelation of the new covenant law with the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessings are now going to come through the new covenant, whereas the old covenant seemed to only deliver the curses. So here Matthew is really helping his Jewish Christian readers appreciate the fullness of Jesus Christ as he fulfills everything that you find in the old, going back to Adam, going back to Abraham, going to Moses, and the Exodus and the Passover, and especially, as we'll see when we come back in just a minute, the Son of David and the kingdom that God established with the Davidic covenant. When we come back in just a minute, we're going to turn our focus to see the Davidic themes and how Jesus Christ the King, the Son of David, fulfills these kingdom promises, not just in the heavenly kingdom, but the heavenly kingdom as it is on earth in the church. Come back and join us in just a minute.
Teach us, good Lord, to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor and not ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do your will.
Good to have you back. This is Our Father's Plan. I'm Jeff Cavins along with Dr. Scott Hahn. You joined us right in the middle of a fantastic conversation. We're talking about Jesus, the New Testament, reading through the Bible. And right now we're talking about the Davidic covenant.
Right. Yeah, we're seeing in Matthew's gospel how there is a special emphasis placed upon Jesus' fulfillment of these Davidic promises and his perfection of the Davidic kingdom covenant. In fact, one professor, Kingsbury, has described Matthew as the gospel of Peter. That's something else I'd like to bring into this, too, in just a moment or so. But as we look at Matthew's presentation, we see our Lord in chapter 12 announcing something that must have been provocative. There in Matthew 12, verse 42, he compares himself to Solomon. He says, "The queen of the south will arise at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Now, that's a remarkable claim for himself. But it's actually given right on the heels of something else that he said earlier, because earlier in Matthew 12, back in verse 6, he said, "I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." So Jesus is saying, you know the son of David, Solomon, the man of wisdom, the king of Israel, the one who built the temple of God. You know the temple and its holiness and its centrality. Well, these two things point to me, and I surpass them both. It's hard for us 20 centuries later to gauge the reaction that would have elicited right. on the part of the Jewish hearers. These are remarkable assertions, but they're true. And they have to be stated, because that's the only way that people are going to really appreciate all the Father is doing in giving us his Son. And this also builds upon the Davidic covenant, because you go back to 2 Samuel 7, verses 12, 13, and 14, and there God gave the promise that the son of David would be his son, something that was only fulfilled in a partial sense by Solomon. By covenant adoption, Solomon, the son of David, became the son of God. But here is Jesus, who from all eternity is the son of God, who enters history then as the son of David. In Matthew 14, we see Peter's role emerging. And I want to bring this to the fore, as well as Jesus being the son of David establishing his kingdom, because you'll notice that he does not establish the kingdom apart from Peter and the disciples. And in fact, we're going to see him giving a very special role to Peter in Matthew 16. In Matthew 14, beginning in verses 22 and going to 36, we see the famous episode of Jesus walking on the water. The disciples get into the boat and they go to the other side, and en route they see Jesus walking in the water in the middle of the night, in the fourth watch of the night. At first the disciples thought it was a ghost. They cry out with fear, but he spoke to them saying, "Take heart, it is I, have no fear." And then Peter stands up and speaks out. Verse 28, Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, bid me come to you on the water." It's interesting that only Matthew records this episode involving Peter expressing this sort of childlike faith. "If it is you, bid me come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." And Peter said, I didn't really mean it. Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But then he saw the wind. He became afraid, began to sink, and he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hands and caught him, saying to him, "O man of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." Now, we might be tempted to kind of make fun of Peter, saying, you know, "man of little faith," but take a second look. Mm-hmm. You know, Peter is the one who said, "If it is really you, bid me to come, and I can walk on the water." Mm-hmm. Now, if Peter said that, believing that it could happen, and then actually stepped out on faith and began to walk on the water, I think, to the best of my knowledge, he's the only other man besides Jesus ever to have walked on water.
I tried once.
Yeah. Was it ice?
Very well, yes. Yeah. Well, you know what, in that story, to me it's fascinating, because Peter is saying, "Lord, if this is you, ask me to do the same thing you're doing."
Yeah. There is a childlike faith. It might be infantile, but it's real. It's substantial. Mm-hmm. You know, so if Jesus is saying, "Oh, man of little faith," to Peter, who was willing to get up out of the boat and walk in the water, I shudder to think what he would say to me, or what he was implying about the other 11 disciples. Mm-hmm. If Peter's faith is little, I can't imagine how infinitesimal theirs must have been at that point. But here is Peter expressing faith and doing the miraculous because he is willing to imitate our Lord. We move on now. In Matthew 16, verse 13, we see Peter emerging once again. When Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples a question. Who do men say the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And these statements are not small claims. I mean, if the people are out there saying Jesus is Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets, or John the Baptist come back to life, they are recognizing the special importance of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But he's not primarily interested in public relations. And so he puts the question right to the 12, but who do you say that I am? And once again, Simon Peter speaks on behalf of the 12. He replies, you are the Christ. Christ is not Jesus' last name, and H is not his middle initial. Christ is a title. Mm-hmm. Christos means anointed one. It's the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Mashiach, which means the anointed one, referring to the king who was anointed by the high priest who also was anointed. So you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter got it right. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Petros, rock. And on this Petra, rock, I will build my church. Now, some people say, wait a second here. You can't really say, you are rock, and on this rock I will build my church, because after all, the word for rock that he gives to Peter is Petros in the masculine, which means small stone, whereas when he says, on this rock I will build my church, he switches to the feminine form, Petra, which means large boulder. And so some fundamentalists have attacked the Catholic teachings at this point and said that it is not really upon Peter as rock that Jesus builds his church. Now, we can't get into a long debate about this, and I do have some tapes that address this more fully. But I would say this, that the vast majority of Protestant scholars now concur with the Catholic interpretation, that there's really no differentiation here at all. First of all, because most likely Jesus was not speaking Greek when he was talking to the disciples, he was speaking Aramaic. And in the Aramaic, there is no way to distinguish between masculine and feminine, small stone and large boulder. There is one word for rock, and in fact, it's where we get the word Cephas. Kypha would have been the word that Jesus used in saying, you are Kypha, and on this Kypha I will build my church. So in the Aramaic, Jesus could not have distinguished between a small pebble, Peter, and a large boulder.
Now, I've also heard people interpret this as saying that Jesus says, I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, that this rock is the rock of revelation. Upon this rock of revelation, this what you have said now, that will become, that the fact that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God, that will become.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I would follow a Protestant exegete over in Germany, Gerhard Meyer, who says this, that, you know, even if we do have it refer to Peter's faith, or Peter's confession, or the revelation of truth expressed by Peter for the first time, you can't separate that from Peter. Mm-hmm. There's just no way. In fact, Meyer says it's nothing really but anti-Catholic bias that would lead someone to say it's Peter's faith, but it's not Peter as a person. You can't separate the two. And so Jesus is clear when he says, you are rock, and on this rock I will build my church. Notice he doesn't say, Peter, go build me a church, or on this rock I will build my churches. Jesus says, on this rock I will build. Peter is not the builder. The disciples aren't the builders. We aren't the builders. Jesus is the builder of his church. I will build your church, Peter, and you a church, John, and you a church. No, I will build my church. So when we as Catholics read this text and hear Jesus pledging to build his church, his one worldwide church upon the rock of Peter, it isn't because Peter's so strong that we believe in the papacy. It's because Jesus is so faithful. Mm-hmm. It's because of Jesus' omnipotent love. We know what he wants to do. He said so. I will build my church on this rock. It isn't Peter's strength. It isn't his rock-like quality. It's Christ being rock-like and conveying that rock-like stability to an otherwise fallible sinner.
Sort of translate that over into how we as Catholics view the Holy Father, the Pope.
Yeah, in fact, that is the question of the hour, because in the very next verse we find the answer. He says, I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. I would say that verse 19 is every bit as significant as verse 18, that the keys represent an image that is just as significant as the rock, if not more so. Why do I say that? Because the keys of the kingdom of heaven are spoken of by Jesus in the closest possible connection with the church. Jesus only uses the word church twice in all four Gospels, both times in Matthew. Here is the first time. And when Jesus announces his intention to build his church, not his churches, not our churches, he is going to build his one church. He does it upon the rock of Peter, but he does it by giving him the keys of the kingdom. In other words, the church that Jesus builds is the earthly manifestation of the kingdom he establishes and fulfills. There's no way you can separate these two when Jesus connects them so closely. I will build the church upon the rock, and he who is the rock, Peter, I'm going to give him the keys of the kingdom. Now, what did Jesus mean when he gave to Peter the keys of the kingdom? And how does that relate to Pope John Paul II or any of the successors of Peter who reign as popes and bishops, as the bishops of Rome? I would suggest that the key for understanding this is found in the Old Testament. And once again, Protestants and Catholic interpreters agree that when Jesus speaks of the keys of the kingdom, he is citing an Old Testament passage that we find in Isaiah 22. Now, whenever a New Testament writer quotes from an Old Testament text, he doesn't wrench the text out of context, especially our Lord. He expects you to go back to the context, understand the contextual meaning, and bring that as light to bear upon its usage in the New Testament. So Jesus gives to Peter the keys of the kingdom. Okay. You go back to Isaiah 22 and you discover that the Son of David did not rule the Davidic kingdom by himself. He ruled it through a royal cabinet of royal ministers. Now, there might have been a minister of defense, a minister of communication, a minister of transportation, but between the king and the royal ministers always stood a prime minister. And everybody knew who the prime minister was because he was the one to whom the king gave the keys of the kingdom. You look and you discover that Shebna had been the prime minister under Hezekiah.
Okay, we're in Isaiah 22.
Isaiah 22 and verse 20. In that day I will call my servant Eliakim to replace Shebna. And I will clothe him with your robe, and I will bind your girdle on him, and will commit your authority to his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He foreshadows the Pope. The Pope is called Pope because he's the spiritual father of the kingdom here. He's the vicar of Christ in this sense. He shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, and I will place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open, and none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. That's an amazing similarity. It's practically the same statement that Jesus is making in connection with Peter. He's saying to Peter, I give you the keys of the kingdom. Why? I'm the Son of David. I'm establishing in the church the Davidic kingdom, and I'm going to rule through my 12 royal ministers, the 12 apostles. In fact, later on in Matthew 19, he says, you 12 will sit on 12 thrones and rule the 12 tribes of Israel. But between Jesus, the Son of David, the king, and the 12 royal ministers, there is one man who stands as prime minister, just like Eliakim back in Isaiah 22. And everybody in the kingdom knows who the prime minister is because he is the one to whom the king passes the keys of the kingdom. And he who has the keys can bind in a binding way. So that if the minister of defense says, we're going to go to war, but the prime minister says, no, we're not, they don't go to war. He is the one who has the final say. So Peter is the prime minister because he has the keys of the kingdom. But again, if you look at Isaiah 22, you discover that the keys don't just symbolize the prime minister. Even more, they're a sign of the prime minister's office. And so the office of the prime minister had been filled at one point by Shebna, who ruled as prime minister under King Hezekiah, and then he leaves office, leaving a vacant office. So there is no prime minister. There is a vacancy that needs to be filled by a successor. Who is the successor? Eliakim. How do we know that Eliakim is the successor? Because Eliakim is the one that Hezekiah entrusts the keys of the kingdom to. So after Eliakim, the office is vacant. Somebody else would have received the keys, and on and on. This permanent institution is found in the Davidic kingdom for centuries. In fact, it's found in all the ancient kingdoms of the ancient Near East. So when Jesus is speaking to Peter about the rock, I will build my church upon this rock and I give you the keys of the kingdom. Given the Old Testament background in Isaiah 22, I don't believe there would have been any mistaking Jesus' intention to single out Simon Peter so that he would serve as the vicar of the king, as the first prime minister in the new covenant kingdom that we would identify with as the church. I build my church upon this rock, and I give to this rock the keys of the kingdom so he will reign in my place as my vicar, as my prime minister. When Peter dies, an office is vacant.
Okay.
And so a successor is demanded. And so we have in the keys not only a symbol of the prime minister under the Davidic king, but a symbol of the office of prime minister.
Okay.
So Peter's primacy is clearly signified, but the succession of office is as well. Therefore, when Peter died, it would have been something automatic for the church to look for a successor and to appoint him. And that's exactly what the church did. For centuries and centuries, hundreds of popes later, we have in Pope John Paul II, the successor to Peter, the vicar of Christ, the prime minister of Christ's new covenant kingdom, the church upon earth. And that's how we trust the Pope. It isn't the Pope who's a sinner.
It's the authority.
It is Jesus' authority.
That's
Jesus' fidelity.
That's beautiful. You know, as a former Protestant, nobody ever brought this up about Isaiah chapter 22. And I used to always tell people, where is there precedence for the papacy in the Old Testament? And you give us a beautiful
Yeah, this really is the primary biblical basis for the church's teachings about the Pope as the successor to Peter and the Petrine primacy that the Pope has by virtue of his Petrine succession. And it's important, I think, for Catholics, especially in studying the Bible, to understand the biblical basis for our belief. Because ultimately, we don't trust Pope John Paul II. We trust Jesus Christ and his omnipotent love and his capacity to work through people like Peter and all of his successors up to the present Pope. Because ultimately, the reason why we believe whatever the Pope authoritatively teaches is because it's Jesus Christ, the Son of David, the omnipotent King, who is teaching through this organ, through this instrument, through his prime minister. He says, in effect, whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven. Why? Because I am going to watch over you. I am going to superintend the process of your teaching, and I will infallibly preserve you from teaching error as though it's truth, or from condemning truths as though they're errors.
So there's a divine-human participation here, cooperation.
Exactly. I mean, the Pope doesn't wake up one morning and say, gee, I feel infallible. I'm going to write myself an encyclical. No. The Pope has to pray. The Pope has to confess his sins. The Pope is the first to acknowledge that he is, like Peter, a weak, fallible human being. But because of Jesus' faithfulness, because of his pledge, because of the Old Testament background that illuminates the meaning of Jesus' pledge, we know that despite the fallible tendencies of every pope, Jesus Christ stands behind him as the reigning king, teaching his people, his subjects, his brothers and sisters, the infallible truth.
In the last few minutes that we have, Dr. Han, this idea of binding and loosing, can you give us an example of how this works out in the modern-day papacy, the Pope binding, loosing, the Church allowing, disallowing?
Well, we can do that, but I think we're going to need more time.
Okay.
In fact, I think we're going to need future sessions to show how the popes have based their teachings upon the Bible as well as the authority that Christ gives them. But I would say this, that whenever the Pope speaks as Christ's vicar, as the teacher of the universal Church, whenever the Pope speaks with the authority that Christ has given to him, Christ himself preserves him from misleading the church. And so when we hear the Pope's teachings, when we hear the teachings of the Second Vatican Council, we should train our ears to listen. With the ears of faith, we'll hear the voice of Christ, the voice of our King, speaking through his representative, his vicar. And we'll see back in Isaiah 22 that the Prime Minister is called Father by the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And so we see in the Pope a father figure. Just as Jesus images the Father, so the Pope is a vicar of Christ. He is our spiritual father figure, the unity of God's earthly family, a living sign of that spiritual unity that makes us the family of God. Come back and join us next week, because we're going to dig deeply into the Scriptures again and make the faith come alive. Thank you very much.
This has been Our Father's Plan with Jeff Cavins and Scott Hahn.